The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. And David, you talked to Albert Cheng. Just like we had promised the listener, you had talked to the head of the World Gold Council in China, Albert Cheng, about just the dynamic growth. I mean, we've got three decades of growing gold demand in China, but at this point you had mentioned that it is reaching a warp speed. It's just going into hyperdrive. And just a reminder, we do have transcriptions of each of the programs if you just check the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary site.
Development of the gold market has been robust over the last three decades. And you're right, it is moving into an even quicker pace. As we mentioned a few weeks ago, looking at the Shanghai Futures Exchange and the Shanghai Gold Exchange, and the sort of fundamental, the nuts and bolts, the transition from them being merely price takers as consumers to price makers as traders of the commodity, in excess of what we see in London and New York. That's still a future aspiration, but they're very intent on target setting and goal completion. And I think this is where talking with Albert is absolutely critical. Albert worked with the Royal Bank of Canada decades ago, introducing the maple leaf into the Asian context, and knows from the ground up what consumption habits and behaviors have been throughout Asia. Now headquartered in Singapore and responsible for the entire Asia region, he is very keenly aware of how that development has taken place.
Albert, thank you for joining the conversation. There's so many things that are developing in the gold market, and we have, as a company, benefited from the work that the World Gold Council has done for years. We look at your research as very important to understanding the supply and demand dynamics in the marketplace, and you're managing director in the Far East for the World Gold Council. I think that's particularly important today, as we've seen a trend which perhaps started 30 years ago, the importance of demand in Asia compared to demand for the product in the U.S. and Europe. It's been on the increase, and now even more so. Maybe we could just start there. What do you see as this trend carrying forward, or is this a short-term anomaly? 30 years might suggest that it's been in place and will remain in place, but maybe you can speak to that.
Oh, thank you, David. Thank you for having me. You are asking me a subject that I have been closely involved in the last almost 30 years. I remember 1985 when I joined the Canadian Mint, selling maple leaf in the region. At that time, my boss from Canada, Canadian Mint, he was actually looking to set up a distribution network in Hong Kong to sell maple leaf. And at that time, what have driven him to come to Asia was he has started a business in North America, selling very well in Canada and US, and venture out into Europe, selling very well in Germany, Austria. But then he said, our market is not just limited to North America and Europe, we have to look east. So he started to visit first Japan. Japan is the first Asian market that had opened up to gold, which is in the late 70s, right after the U.S. opening. And we have seen that Japan, jewelry and as well as investment demand was in a peak in the 70s and 80s until this so-called 20 years of lost decade that Japanese economy went into trouble, that so is the gold markets gradually subside. But at the same time, we see the emerging of Southeast Asia first in the 80s, and then eventually we see in the last 10 years, China. The market, the global gold market, is actually in the last 30 years gradually moving from the center in the West, in US, in Europe, gradually moving into the Asia part, and started off with Japan, as I said. And for that matter, India has always been an anchor in the Asian market. Historically, India has never come across any colonial rule or any restriction on Indian owning or purchasing or enjoying gold jewelry. There's none of this happened in the past. So there is a consistent history of Indian buying gold jewelry and owning gold for many, many years. In Southeast Asia, it started off as a very restricted market. And I remember in 30 years ago, only Singapore is a free port for gold to come in and go out. All the rest of the market, the Thailand, the Indonesia, the Malaysia, they're all restricted market. Some form of restriction on gold import and gold trading. And likewise in East Asia, China is totally closed in the 70s. It only started to relax a little bit on gold jewelry in the late 70s and then get into 80s. Taiwan was a closed market for a long time until the late 80s that they opened up. So the phenomenon of global market moving from the east, from the west to east, it was 30 years and it escalated in the last 10 years. And the escalation was actually one of the reasons is the participation of China market. And China market was very much controlled by the People's Bank. Under the so-called communist regime, all gold has to be purchased by the state, and if a user wants to buy gold, has to buy from the central bank. So this central purchase allocation system lasts until 2002 when they set up the Shanghai Gold Exchange and allow a market mechanism for people to sell gold and to buy gold through a exchange. And ever since the establishment of the exchange, we see the jewelry business become more vibrant, because at that time, then people who want to produce gold jewelry, people who want to retail jewelry or wholesale jewelry, they don't need to get a special license from People's Bank anymore. It used to be they have to get special license. Now, right after that, no need to get license. This is based on purely market demand and the ability of the manufacturer to produce. And it's really a free market economy for the jewelry market. And the market picked up very fast. From in 2002, the whole of China gold consumption is about 200 tons. Fast track to now, about 12 years later, 13 years. Last year, it was 800 over tons. And in 2013 this year, we are talking about more than 1,000 tons. So in a space of 10, 12 years, the market has increased by 5 to 6-fold. Or in the gold jewelry area, as well as the investment areas.
The third plenum Congress reinforces the five-year plan, a transition in the economy away from government investment and towards enfranchising households and increasing the consumption component of GDP. Mm. It seems that income for the average person or family in China is a very critical variable over the next several years. If or when we see an increase in income, we'll continue to see, or maybe even see, a further escalation in the gold price, or rather, gold demand, and we might assume gold price. Mm. What are your thoughts on income trends in China?
That's correct. I mean, we have a lot of independent study talking about the emergence of the middle class in China. And BCG has released a report not too long ago that by 2020, there will be 280 million middle class people in China. Now, 280 million is actually double the current population of Japan. We know that Japan, before China took over as the second biggest economy, Japan is the biggest economy in the world. And by 2020, we're going to have 280 million middle class, double the size of Japan. And these people are not just young people or old people. These are people who are economic active, creating wealth every day. And the wealth that they create, they have to consume. And that is exactly in line with what you just talked about, is the government is encouraging domestic consumption, changing the business, the economic model in China, instead of relying very heavily on export. China has to look inward to encourage domestic consumption. And domestic consumption is either it is the edible thing, I mean food and beverages, or then you have to talk about apparel and talk about accessorizing to make yourself look pretty, and gold jewelry are one of the items that you will naturally look for them when you have accumulated enough wealth and you want to spend it. And gold has a dual nature. It's both a commodity and also a asset class in the financial market. And Chinese, because they understand gold, and gold is a very simple asset that they have only one price, and it's very accessible in China via the many gold shops in China, and many banks who are providing all kinds of gold products to investors. So the investment component of the gold market in China is also getting bigger and bigger. From a couple of years back, meaning in the beginning of the 2002, when the China Gold Exchange was established, the investment market was talking about 2 or 3 tons. And we are estimating that in 2013 this year, the investment market is about 350
tons. 350 tons for the investment market. Up from 2 to 3 tons.
10 years ago.
That's absolutely fascinating. Well, China surpassed Japan as the second largest economy. Now China is surpassing India as the largest consumer of gold. They're also the largest producer of gold. There's several things we're talking about. General consumption of gold by individuals. Back in 2009, we had an update from the central bank, and it had been many years where we had not heard about an increase in gold reserves. We can only speculate if they're adding to gold reserves today. What are your thoughts? Is the PBOC continuing to add to their gold reserves? Are they waiting to a propitious moment in time where they might announce it's no longer, you know, 1,000 or just above that tons, but it's somewhere competitive with perhaps the Eurozone in terms of gold reserves?
Well, there you ask a million-dollar questions. I think we have to understand that the emerging market, in particular those emerging markets in Asia, are always looking at trying to diversify their foreign reserve because of the wealth that created in the last 10 years, be it Korea or Thailand or China or any of the or even Indonesia. The last 10 years has given them the opportunity to accumulate a lot of wealth through the export business. And we have seen Thailand, we have seen Korea, we have seen India all adding gold into their reserve. And they have made it very public, announced at the time that when they purchased. I think different countries have different policy of treating their reserve and reporting their reserve to IMF. So we have to respect that. But the fact that the central bank investors like individuals. Now, why individual has choose to invest more in gold, particularly after the 2008 supply crisis, and then followed by all these crises, either it's in Europe or overall the global financial crisis, is people be looking at the role of gold in their portfolio, and they did put in more percentage in gold. And hence, we see there is an escalated increase in consumption in the investment sectors. And the case in point in China was in the last 10 years, investment component has increased from 210 to 350. It is a sign of not only because of the availability. Of course, availability counts. I mean, now you basically, if I count the actual number of doors open for gold investment through banks, I would say more than 100,000 branches of banks has opened up for people to invest in gold. So availability is
in China. 100,000 branches for banks.
Where you walk in, you want to buy either physical gold, or you can buy gold saving account.
Tell me about the gold savings accounts, because this is something so foreign to the U.S. person dealing with a U.S. bank that fortunately, they know enough to spell gold, G-O-L-D. They could not tell you what number it is on the periodic table. And frankly, most people in the financial arena in the United States have never actually held or are familiar with the actual products. You can actually have gold backing your savings? I mean, how does that work?
Well, this gold saving account is as simple as opening a saving account. It's, the bank will buy on your behalf of the amount of gold that you are willing to purchase at the time of you purchase from them. And the mechanism is, when you say, they will put up the price of gold in gram form. So let's say today per gram is 200 RMB per gram. You just tell the bank to credit into your account 1 gram of gold into your saving book. And then at the same time, debit 200 RMB from your saving account, from your cash account to your gold account. You are debit 200 RMB and then you are credit 1 gram of gold. And behind, the bank will actually purchase that 1 gram of gold on your behalf. Now you may say, purchasing 1 gram of gold is so tiny, and how can a bank do that? But a bank can do that if they have millions of customers. If a million of customers, if each one at different point of time purchase something, then they group it together, and at the back office, they can purchase on behalf of the customer. And this is how the bank has made gold saving so easy. And so people are saving in gold, in a unit of gold, not in a unit of currency.
It's very unique. It's interesting, Albert, you mentioned in your discussions earlier today that there is a proliferation of products and will continue to be a proliferation of products. What you just described is that many of these products have one critical characteristic, accessibility.
Yes, correct.
Accessibility to everyone. I mean, one gram of gold is very accessible. If I work a day, a week, a month, in any of those time spans, I should be able to save and buy 1 gram.
We even have a program, one of the bank, ICBC, has a program where they will actually take an order for a month. It's called a gold accumulation program. What it is a dollar averaging. Let's say this month has 20 working days. And I want to save $10 per day. $10 per day. So I say, bank, I want to buy $10 worth of gold every day in the next 20 days. So in the beginning of the month, I take $200 from your account. And on the day, every day, I buy $10 worth of gold for you. Now, if the day the price of gold is high, your $10 buy less gold. If the price of gold come down, your $10 buy more gold. And then over a year, you will know how much gold you accumulate. But it is no different from spot purchase. The difference of this is you're buying on a daily average and also on a fixed amount. Now, you ask why bank can do that. $10 is a tiny amount. But if you group 1 million customers, 2 million customers, each buy 10, it's a lot of money.
It is.
And this is the economics for banks to do it. And unfortunately, in America, I know, if people want to buy gold, they have to go to a bullion houses or a coin dealers. Yeah. Financial institution doesn't get involved. Yeah. Perhaps it's historical. It's historical that, oh, this business is non-bank business. So let the bullion house run it. But in China, as I mentioned earlier on, China during the early communist regime, nobody had private wealth, so everything is state. And then when China gradually opened up, allowed personal wealth, and then the gold business was only gradually opened up in late 70 on jewelry only, fully opened up since 2002 to everybody. There is no baggage. There's no bullion houses or bullion merchant or coin dealer who has been 100 years of old of history that say, hey, government, we are in this business. Don't let the bank to take over our business. But in the case of China, it is a piece of paper, start from fresh. And in those early days, the local council, including myself, has been actually working with the regulator that this market, if it has to open up and if it has to have a healthy development, financial institutions should involve in a gold business. Because one, they provide the convenience, they provide the credibility, and also it is where people's bank put their money. So having this financial institution to deal with gold, to market gold, is I think is the best distribution system, and which China has adopted.
Now, there's an issue that I think many of our listeners, many of our clients have wondered about, have been confused by. Gold has been going down for 2 years. And yet the demand dynamics have been fairly positive, particularly when you look at the role that China and India play. Over 50% of physical metals are consumed by these two countries. The U.S. market is 6%, according to the World Gold Council. How is it that the price is set largely by the U.S. when our footprint in the marketplace is a fraction of that you find in India and now, even more importantly, China?
I think the gold market, as I just alluded to, is just opened up about 43 years since 71. And the market is started as in London and New York. So these are where the market started. And trading is there and all this logistics is there. And that was 40 years ago. As the market moving east, this is only the consumer that we found. But the trading mechanism is still in North America and still in Europe. And don't forget, the other component of the gold market is the so-called derivative market. The derivative market in the future market, in the option market, and in all these financial products created out of gold are all actually created and engineered in this investment banking, which are by and large in the Western world. So in determining this flow of demand and supply, this also matter. So these price determining factors, which are just what the thing I talk about. Because the East market have just started about 10 years ago, primarily focused on the consumer market. Consumer are price taker. Consumer are not price maker. Only the dealer, the trader are price maker. The consumer are price taker. And the market, let's say in China, are started off with consumer driven market. And it has created this impact. I think the future development of the Eastern market is to create a depth of this other derivative product, the option, the futures, and the involvement of the China participant into the global trading market. And then this then will be reflected fully. And that will be something that will be in the making in the next 10, 15 years, that the global market will merge together. And now it's a little bit lopsided. It's market making, trading here, price taker, consumption market there. But this, the China market is evolving. There will be more people acting. People will be getting involved into the global market.
So the futures exchange that was started just a few years ago here in China will go a long way towards developing the derivative market for gold. And silver and perhaps the other metals as well. Right. The one, there's a positive element to that. The negative element, if there is one, is that it invites speculation and perhaps more volatility. And I wonder if more people are trading gold and silver via the derivatives markets with added volatility, does that begin to change the general person's perception about the stability of gold? Does it undermine, in some sense, those gold accounts and those private holdings of gold, seeing the price erratically moving up and down, not on the basis of supply and demand fundamentals, but perhaps games that can be played again in the futures and options market? What comes to mind is, you know, in the U.S. market, you can sell an asset short without having the asset in your possession. I don't have to own gold to sell it short. Perhaps that can be addressed by the futures exchange here and be...
I think the gold market, like any commodity market, there will be a layer of user and there will be a layer of speculator and a layer of so-called this liquidity provider, which then make it as a market where somebody will take risk for you because they are more risk-taking. But people who are real user, he doesn't want to take the risk and want somebody to share the risk. I think a healthy market will have all component, many users. At the moment, the China market, as I said earlier, is very heavily driven by the consumption market. We need a layer of this to make the market more complete, and also product associated with that in order to make the market more complete. And it's currently is lacking. This is in terms of product. The other thing is in terms of knowledge. The Western world the American, the European, well, as people has been in this business for long enough, there's a lot of knowledge base being accumulated, and which is beneficial when they are participating in the market. When there is, we are lacking of this kind of talent. This requires years to build up into understanding of how it works globally. So I don't see that this is something contradictory. A healthy market need to have all component or all participant and all working towards a goal of making the market liquid for people who want to hedge, for people who want to buy, for people who want to use it and don't want to take the risk. These are all, there are different mechanisms for them to use. And at the moment is lacking sufficient development in the Asian market, which we need to look at it very, very seriously.
Albert, one last question as we wrap up. Most of our questions have dealt with demand components. Looking at the supply of precious metals, you have an inelastic supply. You can't just go out and double production of gold from mines, and there is a set amount of gold that's ever been created. If, in fact, there is a continued increase in demand, given the demographic changes and the economic reforms and political reforms here in China, what do you imagine occurring with supply constraints? And second, to supply constraints, how does that impact the price?
Well, supply constraint is not a new component. It has always been there because it is 6-7 year lag behind exploration or behind a price curve, that how supply can respond to it. The market has been buffered by the adjustment of the scrap gold. The scrap gold is, I would say, is a buffer which is price determinant. When the price was high, you see more people willing to part their old jewelry wear or somehow some of the investment that they forgot about a long time ago, suddenly they remember it and they take it out to the market. So I would say that I'm not too worried about the supply constraint because there was always a buffer stock of this recycled gold. And this recycled gold, of course, is subject to price. And all the gold that has been mined is 174,000 tons and it's there forever. And this amount will gradually add up at a speed of 2,500 tons per year. And this is always there when people want to need it. It's a matter of price.
That is a matter of price. Yeah. Well, Albert, thank you so much for your time, your insights, the continued efforts through the World Gold Council to bring clarity and insight into the gold market. We appreciate you. We appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Albert Cheng. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.